For our panel. It is on, it's called Refresh, and this panel is definitely a refreshing group of Asian American women's voices. The panel, I chose the panel to give a more expansive idea of what Asian American is. So Manija Nesrabadi is Iranian American, Moana is Hongan, and Lisa is Chinese Filipino American. And Chanika is Thai American. So I'm Afghan American. So we've kind of expanded this the notion of Asian America in this panel. I'm really excited to share the works of these writers. They're all friends of mine, colleagues, and I'm definitely fans of their work. The first person speaking will be Manija Nesrabadi, who just came back from Tehran. So. Some questions afterwards, I'm sure. So some great answers. Manija Nesrabadi is a graduate of Brown University. She received an MFA in creative writing and nonfiction from Hunter College in 2007. She's a contributor to About Face, 25 Women Write About What They See When They Look in the Mirror, forthcoming from Steel Press in June. She's also a 2008 recipient of a Hedgebrook writing residency and is currently writing a memoir about becoming part of her extended family in Iran. Jackson Heights, New York, and her uncle's house in Tehran are where she feels at home. She's also co-director of the Association of Iranian American Writers. So, Manija, if you'd like to.
Description of the literature track at this conference. It opens with the sentence, "No longer relegated to the back door of autobiography, Asian American women writers are charting new literary maps through formal and thematic innovations that reflect complex intersections between gender, race, class, sexuality, religion, and language." And I think that this is true and very exciting, but that there's also an ongoing and important role for autobiography or memoir in Asian American literature. And I've chosen to write memoir for several reasons. I think memory and experience, real life histories of struggle and survival, are worthy literary topics. By making meaning out of what I've lived through, out of how my family members have maintained their humanity in the face of hardship, I'm fusing artistic creation with self-reflection and discovery. I'm honoring the people I'm writing about, conferring dignity upon those who've been degraded. And I'm asking my readers to consider the world around them in light of these lived events. I don't think Asian American memoirists have to play the role of the sort of tour guide describing the other for the uninitiated. I think that we can write as much for other Asian Americans, for other people of color, and for ourselves as for white readers who tend to dominate the sort of in the minds of the publishers, the book buying public. Imagining or storytelling has always been a survival strategy of oppressed peoples. Being able to transform one's own experiences into stories, being able to tell those stories without shame, is a critical way of undermining the silences that are necessary for oppression to continue. It's interesting to notice that some Asian American women writers have led the move towards innovation in memoir. Most famously, Maxine Hong Kingston's groundbreaking work, The Woman Warrior, spends the first chapter reimagining the story of a brutal family secret to try to make sense of the author's own tenuous place in American society. Of the aunt whose name she'll never know, she writes, "Unless I see her life branching into mine, she gives me no ancestral help." And this idea of reaching into the past before the life of the author, of reaching for ancestral help, is a particularly important concept for Asian American writers, maybe especially memoirists. Although Asia is a vast and incredibly diverse continent, all of us sitting here have ties to cultures that go back thousands of years. And refusing to ignore that history, attempting to see our own lives in relationship to it, seems to me one of the best antidotes to the powerful erasure of racism and assimilation. And I'll come back to this question of ancestry and history later on in my talk. I also want to mention Fatemeh Keshavarz's book, Jasmine and Stars, which is critical of the recent spate of memoirs about Iran that tend to focus on the negative aspects of the Iranian Revolution and end with the flight to freedom in the United States. Part literary criticism and part memoir, Keshavarz's book, argues that we have to also write about the jasmine and stars, the joy and life and beauty that continue even under dictatorships. Now, Iran is perhaps the most demonized place in the American imagination today. As someone writing about Iran, I obviously don't want to write in a way that's going to bolster this image of, you know, this land of women-hating religious fanatics who support terrorism and want to destroy Israel and America. You've all heard it 1,000 times. But if I only write about the positive things, the mountains and the ancient fire temples, the hospitality and the underground dance parties, I will not have the space I need to tell my story, to break through the silences that kept me alienated from my Iranian heritage and family until fairly recently. And also, if I'm obligated to only write nice things, the question comes again, who am I writing for? I've come to believe that the best way to break down stereotypes in our writing is to tell human stories that will necessarily be full of good and bad and everything in between. Okay, fine, but what do we do when our stories seem to dovetail at certain points with the images used to target us? This is a very important question for me because I'm writing in part about domestic violence. And I'll try to answer it by talking about the approach I've decided to take in my own work. But before I do, I want to add that I think that there's an extra layer of silence to break through because I'm an Asian American woman. And perhaps this will sound familiar to some of you, but as a girl, I was taught to please, to serve, to respect my elders, to protect and take care of my immigrant father. In writing about my father, about family secrets, I run smack into feelings of disloyalty and betrayal. The good Asian daughter is not supposed to write a memoir. So I have to be clear about why I'm writing any of this in the first place. First, my story doesn't come from a place of bitterness or revenge or desire to sell books. For me, this story is about figuring out how to love and understand my father as I learn his language and come to love his family. And second, my father, his brother, and all the Iranians I portray are, like all people, multifaceted human beings who behave different ways in different situations. Kind of sad that's baby things, but especially when it comes to Iranians who do. And I've attempted to show my father in various settings so that a complex portrait of a man, an immigrant, an artist, a revolutionary father emerges. And third, I too found it necessary to reckon with my ancestors. Jews and Zoroastrians, the peoples from whom I am made, were heavily persecuted for centuries. How could it be possible for so much violence and suffering not to leave its mark, not to impact the ways parents treat their children or each other? Now, this is not a matter of condoning domestic abuse or deleting the agency of the people involved, who we sometimes wish would have made better decisions than the ones they made. But it is about pulling back the camera to give a fuller picture of what was going on. The reality is, of course, that violence exists in every culture, and that individuals are both products of their histories and actors within them. Learning about what Zoroastrians had lived through, about the waves of conversion and repression, finding out about my father's experience of poverty and looking into the violence he suffered, all of this has opened up space for me to understand rather than simply condemn. So I'll just give some brief backstory and then read a little excerpt from my memoir. My father, a leftist who was born into a poor, rural Zoroastrian family, came to the U.S. in 1960 to study and to avoid conscription in the Shah's army. The rest of his family stayed behind. In the early 1970s, he met and married my mother, an Ashkenazi Jew from the New Jersey suburbs, who wanted him to try harder to adopt the middle-class aspirations, the American dream that she worked very hard to realize. And I came out in 1975 looking like my father, which in the almost all-white neighborhoods we lived in made assimilation a frustrating task. The way that the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis were portrayed in the American media created a hostile and dangerous climate for all Iranians, including my father. Being Iranian, it seemed, was one of the more undesirable things you could be. So I grew up not learning Persian, not going to Iran, not knowing any of my father's relatives. But it wasn't just the hostility around us or the closed embassies and years of war which kept me from connecting with my Iranian heritage. The fight between my father and my mother's relatives over Iran and Israel brought geopolitical conflict right into our home. And I was under tremendous pressure to pick a side. My father also had a tendency to take his rage, to take his frustration at all the injustices in the world, this rage and violence that he felt, out on the women in his life. And this also pushed me away from him. It was only after September 11th that I realized I had to turn being Iranian into a source of pride rather than a reason to fear becoming a target. I began a journey that took me to my uncle's house in Tehran, where I lived with three generations of my father's family for many months, until our lives had become inextricably intertwined. The experience changed me and them and my relationships with both my parents back in the U.S. To paraphrase Kingston's words, I had to figure out how the world that had been invisible to me in America had shaped my father and had also shaped me. Negotiating a place for myself in an Iranian context was necessary in order to undermine the process of self-erasure and estrangement that I'd been engaged in for so long. So I'm just going to read a very brief excerpt from my memoir, which is titled Carry the Sand Away from the Walls. What you need to know is my father used to walk me home from grade school in our predominantly white neighborhood in Washington, D.C. For those of you who don't know D.C., it's a very segregated city. And along the way, we would often stop and chat with shopkeepers and neighbors. What had been a special time of day that I looked forward to, eventually, as the years went on, became fraught with conflicts of loyalty and identity. Okay. It must have crept up on me, like the slow wilting of summer that suddenly gives way to the rapid decay of fall, the way I came to see my father's foreignness as the source of the problem. By the start of second grade, as darkness crept sooner into the days, I'd learned to mediate, to interpret the words he spoke in English for ears that jammed on an unfamiliar accent or that missed the punchline of his homemade jokes. I would see a palette of beige faces, confused, blank, made plastic by a fake smile. Even as I wanted to distance myself, I felt compelled to help the white American. I hoped he wouldn't notice me acting on their behalf. The impatience in my voice as I translated from English to English, my subtle knowing smile, or the speed with which I interrupted him and said we had to go. I hoped late summer's lingering sweetness would distract him from something rotten, hidden, and growing. One day, like a double agent in a bad made-for-TV movie, I was discovered. "Why are you trying to shut me up?" he said, shoving me two strides forward by the back of my head as we bid an awkward farewell to Mrs. Butterworth from three blocks over. "I wasn't," I lied. The knot of pain in my throat hurt like a piece of hard candy I hadn't meant to swallow. But if I could have spoken, "I was trying to help you. I hate the way they talk to you. I hate the way they look at you. What am I supposed to do?" Had I betrayed him? The thought that I might have, and that this act might come between us, made me feel lost, as if the streets we knew by heart had turned hostile and foreign. He wouldn't look at me or hold my hand the rest of the way home. I didn't dare kick any of the fallen leaves that had begun to accumulate and cover the sidewalk. After dinner, my mother took my younger sister upstairs for a bath. Sounds of splashing water and staccato instructions trickled down to where my father sat in his armchair, tracing over human figures in the newspaper with his fountain pen. Only then did I venture close to him, peeking around the leather back of his chair. The crease between his brows crept closer together. I rested my cheek on his shoulder. He ignored me. I slipped my arm around his. He concentrated on his drawing. Little by little, I wedged my body through the loop of his arm, working my way into his lap so that his sketch pad rested on my knees. He said nothing as I watched his pen dance across the page, the trail of its dashing motion leaving behind an arm, a leg, a sweep of flyaway hair. Relief snug around me, I willed our upsetting afternoon to shrivel up and fall from his memory. I'd kick it into the gutter like so many dead leaves.
Our next reader is by Moana Lucia Matutalpaki Niwatolu.
Got it right.
Or Moana. She is an artist, painter, poet, actor, activist, educator, community organizer, leader, and superwoman. She graduated from New York University in the studio art program, concentrating in painting, and earned the Ellen Stokoe Fellowship from Yale University. As a graduate student, she attended Columbia University in the theater master's program and then worked at the United Nations in New York City. She is the founder of Pacifica New York City, a nonprofit organization for indigenous people of the Pacific Ocean on the East Coast. And she's also founder of Mahina Movement, of course, and she has CDs. One.
Thank you so much, Zora, for having me here. And thank you guys for coming to our panel this morning. It's an honor to be a part of the Asian American Women Conference here at CUNY. So my name is Moana Lucia Matutalpaki Niwatolu, but you can call me Moana or Mo if you want to. I was born in Nuku'alofa Tonga, which is part of the Polynesian Islands in the Pacific Ocean. We are proud to say that's where time begins. That's where the international dateline goes through, and it's south of Samoa and right next to Fiji, where my mom's family comes from. And from there, 3 months after I was born, I was raised in Hawaii and Provo, Utah, because my family became Mormon. And when I was 16, I no longer wanted to be a Mormon, so I left the Mormon church and I came to New York City at age 18 with $1.76 in my pocket. I'm like, hey, this is what immigrants do, right? We follow our dreams. We want to live the American dream. And what Zora didn't put in my bio was, you know, I've washed dishes, babysat, mopped floors, have done so much just so I could be here. To live my dream, and mainly just like what the women said this morning in the opening, mainly to live all our dreams, all our family's dreams, all our parents, why my parents brought me here, and just our whole generation. So I'm honored. Today's gonna be the first public reading I'm gonna do of my one woman show. That's going to be at PF 122 called Tongue and Pain. And what this one-woman show is, I started writing it when I was 19, and it's my experience of being the artist that I always wanted to be here in New York City. And not only does it include my own story, but it includes my father's story. It includes my mother's story and all the people that supported me and that I've grown up or have actually, like, challenged me. And you'll hear it. So here's just a snippet of it. So there's the last painting, and in walks this character. There's 13 characters in this play. That's the last one? Interesting. I don't get it. Why do you have to bring up race? What's your race anyway? You're not black, so I don't understand why you're so angry. There are two kinds of people in this world, Moana. People who have desire and people who don't. Apparently, you do have desire, and your desire is to be angry. I feel this energy from you, this energy of, is that how your culture is? Wow. Why are you so angry? Your anger is trendy. Do you know what the word rigor means, Moana? I don't get rigor from your painting. I don't really get that you're a painter. I don't think you are. You have to feel rigor. That is what is missing from your painting. Rigor. Look it up. Look it up in the dictionary. Someone give her a dictionary? What you need here is, what you need is
You need to make white people feel stupid. You need to want us to feel guilty. That will make us want to know this information you are trying to tell me. We want to know things. You have some information I apparently don't know. I feel stupid, and now I don't want to look at your paintings. That's interesting to me, because I don't want to feel stupid. Then you will be successful. Do you look at other ethnic artists? Do you see what they do? I say look at them. Look at what they do, and you will see. They do make white people feel stupid. Look at the successful ones. Those are the ones to look at.
Hello, Mona. How are you today? You seem a little down. Are you okay? Where have you been? I haven't seen you for a while. I like how your hair is today. It's nice. I like your curls. I like your hair. It's pretty. I thought you were black. You're not black? Oh, well then. You must be... Oh, I can see it now. You're black Chinese. I didn't notice that before. All right, Mona. See you tomorrow. Hope you feel better.
Kia ora. Talopa. No, wait, I know. Malala Le. Am I right? I'm right. My wife is Samoan. Sina, do you know? Do you know my wife, Sina Tupokaskipi? He went to Granger. Those are some big guys. The biggest guys I've seen. Huge guys. Now he plays for the NFL. I really love the Tongan culture, just Polynesians in general. They're so nice and great folks. My brother Tim went on his Mormon mission to Tonga, and I went on my Mormon mission to Samoa. That is where I met my wife, Sina. He married a Tongan girl, of course. Our kids are really cute. I make sure my kids speak Samoan, and my brother Tim makes sure his kids speak Tongan. It's very important, you know. Do you speak your language? Yes, I mean, do you speak Tongan? Do you speak it fluently? You know, the church is good to us and our families. When I found out that I was going to serve my Mormon mission in Samoa, I was very excited, and my whole family was happy. Are you still a Mormon member? When we lived in West Valley, I remember going to luau's with Tom and Jimmy, Tupacipi, you know, my late cousins. It was so great. After football games, we would go over to their home, and those guys can eat. Oh, it was great to meet you. All the best with your life. Yo, man, yo, shorty with long hair. Shorty! Yo, you Hawaiian or something? I like your hair. You have that Hawaiian look. You know what I'm saying?
You what?
Tongue what? Huh? Yo, you tongue? That's what I'm talking about. Yo, you want to get married? Will you marry me? I love you. Come on, give me a chance. Oh, word? That's what I thought. Oh, she said she loves me too. Yo, I love you too. Come back here, Shorty. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah. And then there's the MC, and he introduces the first character. You see a Gauguin painting on the backdrop, and then she comes out of it. Are we done yet? She takes out a cigarette from her hair right next to her flower, and she takes out a lighter out of her lava, and she starts smoking. I'm so sick of this place. Like what? What? What are you looking at? You looking at me? You looking at me? I know I'm in a painting and all, and you're supposed to look at me, but hello, when I'm not in the painting anymore, you don't have to stare.
Has anyone ever told you that you look like one of those women in a Gauguin painting?
Yeah, like you think you're the first one who said that to me? Get on the fucking line. Get a fucking clue. No, No one has ever said that to me. You and the millions of fucking people that come to this museum. No, someone has never said that to me. Get on the fucking line. She talks again.
My name is Paradise, and I live right here on 5th Avenue and 86th Street at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, otherwise known as the Met in the NYC. So I'm supposed to do a fucking dance for you, do a fucking song for you, share with you some food from my culture. I'm telling you right now, fuck no, fuck no. Fucking aloha to you, fucking kiora to you, fucking whatever fuck to you, and fucking malo mucking fucking talofa to you. Fuck. That's what I say. As for the food, just get a fucking hot dog or pretzel from the fucking street. Throw pineapple on it, call it Polynesian. There you go. As a matter of fact, there's some stands right outside on the museum. Fuck. She shows a Gucci bag. You like it? I'm the real authentic tongue in here, baby. Fuck. You know, I'm a painter too, not just Gauguin. He's not the only one who paints women in the Pacific. Hello! I'm a woman from the Pacific, and I paint my own motherfucking self, so I paint Pacific women too, kind of. You just don't know. You didn't know that, huh? Well, now you know. You know, I checked this guy out. Since I'm in one of his paintings and everything, I feel like he knows more about me than I do about him. So I had to do my research. I do research. I read all his journal entries. Fuck, I remember when I first got here, it was the first time the Met displayed its entire Gauguin collection. I know for me, it was the first time to be in a museum with so many Polynesian women at once. That was a big deal for me. I wonder if I were to have a conversation with him like right now, like he was sitting there where you're sitting and we were talking, I would say, Gauguin, Mr. Paul Gauguin, you saw these women. Did you paint them in ways that they don't see themselves? Did they show you and share with you intimate things that they wouldn't even share with themselves? I'm interested in this. I want to know. I told you I paint, right? I do, I paint. I don't paint right now. You see, I'm working here, right here. I paint the bills because I gotta work. I pay the bills. I'm an independent woman. I'm very busy, but I paint. I paint. When I get the time, I will paint. I'll show you I paint. You know what I paint? I paint spaces. You know, right here, this space between you and me, or that space between you and her, or him and her. That's what I like to paint. Space. The light and the dark, that's what I paint. Sometimes I just paint spaces you don't even see. That's what I paint. Uh-huh, that's right. Sometimes I don't even have space, and that's what I paint. That I don't have space. I've never painted people. You know those artists that paint people? I don't paint people. I paint space. My lack of it, my far beyond the eye can see of it. The space between teeth. That's what I paint. Hey, you paint me? And I paint you, or your space. I am the painted and the painter. How you like that, huh? Ring, ring, ring. Hello? Hello? Hello, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Where do you think I am? Motherfucker, Tahiti? No, motherfucker, I'm in New York fucking city. To make a long story short, I got mugged on 86th and Madison. They think I'm a tourist. Do I look like a fucking tourist to you? Good. I ain't no fucking tourist. My bag got jacked, I had to get a new passport, la-di-da-di, I'm at the airport, I want to see some Pacific Ocean, okay? May I please see your passport? Your name is Paradise?
Yes, lady, my name is fucking Paradise.
Where did you go?
We were calling you.
You didn't hear us?
Passenger Paradise, we are paging. Passenger Paradise.
Your plane has already left. There will not be any more flights scheduled for some time now.
And I missed it. That's why I'm still here. They couldn't wait for me. That's why I am still here. They couldn't wait for fucking Paradise.
I want to end with the last one, last character that I'm going to share with you, called Big Julio Tangata.
I live in Queens! I ride the 7 train to Sunnyside! I bring my kids! I brought my kids to this state! I got 5 kids! I look at those Godfather movies and I love them! That's the Tolan family! That's us! That's our culture! That is a Tongan family. My dad, he wanted us to watch Scarface too. That was too bloody. My mom is like, oh, Al Pacino. Because she can't say Al Pacino, so she has to Tonganize it so she can say it. Pacino. I brought some kava for you today. This is a bat all the way from Fiji. Here you go. I just want my dad to love me the way I wanted him to love me. He would do things that embarrassed the fuck out of me. I remember he would make us lunches. Corned beef, jelly, margarine with onion sandwiches which smelled like him. Old Spice. Who the fuck makes that? I was the only kid who had a sandwich like that. I remember he packed our lunches and he used brown bags, shopping bags with my name in huge black permanent marker on the side so no one could mistake my lunch for theirs. Who would mistake my lunch for theirs? Everyone else had a lunchbox. That was fucked up. I remember my dad never wanted us to wear light-colored clothing. It was always black, brown, or blue, and always from Sears. He wanted to make sure that the dirt wouldn't show on our clothes. Fuck, sometimes I felt like I was in prison wearing those colors every day. I think of you, my age, and you had 5 children just like me. You moved to a whole nother country with your wife and your family and worked in this job that you hated every day. For more than 30 years of your life, this year you turn 70. Happy birthday, Papi. I am this man right now because you are a part of me. You make me happy. You are my father, and I thank you for never leaving. Thank you for bringing me to the country. Thank you for loving me the way you knew how.
Thank you.
Our next reader is Lisa Crowe. She's a writer living in Brooklyn, New York. Her fiction has been nominated for Pushcart Prize and published in the Asian Pacific American Journal, Brooklyn Review, Bullfight Review, and Sassy. She has been awarded writing residencies at the Kimmel Harding Nelson Center for the Arts and the Hayden Institute and Retreat for Writers of Color. Lisa is a web writer for the Independent Lens film series on PBS and a founding staff member of Hyphen, a magazine about Asian America for the culturally and politically savvy. A former New York Foundation for the Arts Fiction Fellow and a recipient of the Van Leer Fellowship in Fiction, she's currently completing No Street Like Home, a collection of linked short stories.
Thank you, and thanks for coming. So for me, writing is also a sort of survival tactic and a method of countering what I call cultural amnesia. And I'm very interested in the stories that lie beneath the surface that are normally not told, and I'm very interested in the characters that often fall between what I call the literary cracks. So I'm currently working on finishing a collection of 10 linked short stories called No Street Like Home, and these stories follow the members of 2 Chinese-American families through a span of 30 years and illustrate the different natures of home from places like New Jersey, New York, San Francisco, Ohio, Manila, Shanghai, Beijing. And I'm just going to read the first part of one of the stories is called Teen Queens. The summer of the murder, Josie Kwan was working at the public library in Warwick, New Jersey, which beats Slinging Hash at Burger King, the only other place hiring in town. The library was air-conditioned, and Josie could hide behind the shelves and read crime books. Her best friend, Liz Wang, teased her and called her Sherlock Kwan, but Josie didn't mind. Nobody her age ever came into the library. She could be as invisible as she wanted. It was her magic power, visible invisibility. In another life, Josie thought, she would have made a good spy. In late July, detectives had found Karen Morgan's body buried deep inside the Ramapo Reservation, nestled inside a ditch covered with leaves and dirt. Karen had been a teen queen, popular, mean, and average student, tan, long hair, hard ass, just on the safe side of slutty. Josie watched the news with her parents at home. Kara's stats had been running on TV so often that she could mouth along, like the words to a favorite song. 15-year-old female, blonde hair, brown eyes, abducted from her after-school job at Aldo's Pizzeria on July 14th. On the news, Kara's parents clutched one another as local authorities carried a body bag against the backdrop of now infantile. They insisted she was a good girl, and the reporters played this up, because no harm should come to good girls, only to girls gone bad, spoiled like milk left out on the counter for too long. Someone had kept Kara somewhere, assaulted her in ways Josie could not conceive of. She had been missing for a week, dead for 3 days. Where had she been during that week? The news reports talked about how Kara was going into her junior year at Warwick High School. Josie already knew this. She had graduated from the same school in June. In the fall, she would be off to college. It was a small school, and she knew who Karen Morgan was, could have easily picked her out of the crowd, although they had never spoken. Josie had not played sports, but Kara had played field hockey, and Josie had seen her once in bulky knee pads in a green jersey, racing along the grass, passing the ball to her teammates. Mrs. Vermeer, the children's librarian, was crying again. Last night's news about Kara had caused many Warwick adults to bolt their doors and remain tethered to their television. "I feel like she was my own daughter," Mrs. Vermeer said. With her eggplant-shaped body and purple turtlenecks, the librarian reminded Josie of a children's cartoon dinosaur. She queried Josie between the books on tape and the large print shelves and said far too loudly, "That girl is hanging out with a rough crowd. She was headed in the wrong direction." Josie wondered what the right direction was. She was sure that being inside the Warwick Public Library, with its faint smell of paste and mildewed senior citizens, on a sunny afternoon, was one right direction. Mrs. Vermeer placed a hand on Josie's shoulder and said in a watery voice, "A girl your age, she was just a baby." Steadying her hands, Josie concentrated on arranging the 900 books by call number. She pulled her ponytail back into the black scrunchie that she only wore at work and wanted to tell Mrs. Vermeer that she was 2 whole years older than Kara, legal age almost, and was definitely not a baby. "Phone call," Mrs. Vermeer said, waving at Josie from the front desk. Jeremy Reyes was on the other end of the line, breathing loudly. "I finished another board of Resident Evil 2 today," he announced. "Congrats," said Josie. Jeremy's biggest passions in life were video games and the Yankees. Once Josie caught him picking his nose and eating the fine. He had thick eyebrows, greasy hair, and acne. He still wore tidy whiteies. He was one of those Warwick boys that she had known for years but never noticed. 2 weeks after graduation, he had come into the library to borrow a copy of Sports Illustrated and a science fiction novel Josie had read in the fifth grade. There was nothing but white noise on the other end of the line. Josie could almost smell the heavy tang of Jeremy's breath. When she kissed him, he tasted like butter that had gone sour. She would never have been hanging out with him so much that summer if her friend Liz were around. "You still there?" she asked. "Yeah." Mrs. Vermeer squeezed behind the checkout counter, her corduroy-clad hips straining against the media material shelf. She extracted a cardboard box with plastic containers from the bottom shelf and held them up to Josie with a stern expression. "Film strips. I have to get back to work. I'll call you later." Pushing the returns cart into the back corner, Josie ignored the media materials and read The Encyclopedia of Serial Killers. which she kept misfiled on a remote shelf in the children's section, and which no one, to her knowledge, had ever borrowed. Her favorite entry told of a trunk discovered at a train station to contain the parts of 12 missing boys. The killer had been about to board a train to Canada when a porter noticed small droplets of blood leaking from the bottom of his trunk. The killer had almost gotten away. So many more, then, must have gone unnoticed, Josie thought. So many bodies could be buried in places no one knew about, people once reported missing and since forgotten. Josie and her parents ate dinner while watching the 6 o'clock movie. There were no new facts on Kara. Instead, the TV was displaying photos of Kara with her friends at Myrtle Beach on spring break, followed by footage of her two best friends crying. Their names were Ashley and Michelle, skinny white girls with long wavy hair. "Kara was my best friend," sobbed Ashley. "I can't believe this. How could someone do this?" moaned Michelle. Josie's mother blinked at her daughter in the same way that Mrs. Vermeer had at the library, pleading and desperate. "You didn't know her, did you?" she asked. "She wasn't in my grade," Josie said. "She played field hockey." Josie's father wiped his mouth. "You knew her? What did she look like?" "I don't know," Josie said. "Blonde." Josie's mother chewed. It was probably the parents. Those parents let their kids run around wild. The other day in the ShopRite parking lot, I saw a girl your age kissing her boyfriend. Josie's father wrinkled his nose. "Kissing?" he exclaimed. "Kissing," her mother said. "That girl must have taken drugs," her father said. "That Kara girl." Josie filled her mouth with broccoli. "Oh, Josie doesn't know anything about drugs," her mother declared. "She'd never do drugs." Josie sipped her milk. Her parents would never suspect her of anything. They didn't know about the things she did with Jeremy, even though, much to Josie's consternation, they had yet to have sex. Go all the way. Do it. Josie wished her parents would say something, anything about Jeremy, but their silent approval of him made him seem even more unattractive. They trusted her, they said. They were sure she would do nothing to disappoint them. Josie borrowed her mother's car and drove across town to Jeremy's house on Crestview Lane. His father, she knew, was away on a business trip, and his mother, he had mentioned on the phone, was at a school board meeting. Tonight, Josie swore, she would get Jeremy to do it with her. She rang the doorbell 3 times before someone answered. It was Jeremy's 7-year-old brother. His mouth was ringed with a sticky blue residue, a popsicle aftermath. "Hi," Josie said. "Is your brother home?" She heard a shattering explosion echo inside the house. Most Warwick residents might have had their TVs permanently tuned into the news tonight, eager for the latest facts on the Kara Morgan case. But the Reyes home was permanently tuned into Resident Evil 2. Jeremy was sitting cross-legged on the carpet of the TV room of the Reyes' 5-bedroom house, wearing a Yankees cap, Simpsons t-shirt, and blue track pants that were so shiny Josie could see double in them. He was jabbing at control buttons while staring at the TV screen, which was about 10 inches away from his face. An open package of Nutter Butters lay at his feet, with a half-eaten cookie bleeding its crumbs out onto the carpet. "Hi," Josie said. He didn't look up. "I'm in extreme battle." "Okay." Josie stepped behind him, sitting on the carpet with her back against the sofa. She watched him play and pretended to be interested. She scolded herself for wearing lipstick and a black sundress with a tiny daisy print. It was too obvious, unlike the Levi's and flannel shirts that she usually wore. After half an hour, she walked up the stairs to Jeremy's room. On the nightstand was a boy's plastic clock shaped like a football. The bed in which she had removed her pants just last week was unmade, white drool stains caked across the dark green pillowcases. Josie lay down in the bed and pulled the sheets over her, slightly repulsed. She waited for Jeremy to come upstairs. When he finally did, she was not asleep, but lying still, with the sheets pulled over her head. He peeled the sheets back. "What are you doing in there?" He smelled like peanut butter. Josie raised her head up from the pillow and steered Jeremy towards her. The slippery fabric of his track pants brushed against her fingers. He kissed her, jamming his tongue into her mouth until she could barely breathe, saliva overflowing onto her chin. Josie remembered when she was 5 and decided to eat a paper napkin to see if it had any taste. It hadn't, but instead the paper grew sodden and lumpy in her mouth until she thought it would choke her. Propping himself up by his elbows, Jeremy slid himself over her, then tentatively placed a clammy hand under her dress. Come on, Josie said when Jeremy removed his mouth from hers and came up for air. Let's do it. Jeremy pulled back, his eyebrows furrowed. He looked like a scared boy. His hand was still tangled in her dress. Why not? Josie asked. Don't you want to? He sat up, pants swishing abruptly against the sheets. I don't know what to do. Josie pulled Jeremy's arm away, jumped out of the bed, and ran down the stairs. She began crying until she was safely inside her car. Jeremy did not come after her. She peeled out of Crestview Lane and towards downtown Warwick. While crossing the intersection at Franklin Avenue, she noticed that the light in the library was on, even if it was hours past closing time. She made a U-turn and pulled into the parking lot. When Josie got home that night, she would look at the slice of light shining from the hallway under the doorframe of her bedroom, a sign that her parents were still awake. She was not in the woods. She was not in the ditch. If a knock came at her window, she could scream and somebody would hear. But she would go, too, out the window and away from the prying street lamps if someone knocked hard enough. Thank you.
And our last presenter is Tanika Svetlis. She's a Brooklyn-based artist, has exhibited at the Queens Museum of Art, Lower East Side Tenement Museum, Rotunda Gallery, and Denver International Airport. Tanika was a recipient of the Brooklyn Arts Council re-grant and was awarded a multimedia residency with Rotunda Gallery. Brooklyn Community Access Television, BCAT, in 2004, and was the artist in residence at Upset Press based in New York in 2003. Her work can be seen in the Neurasian Anthology. Tanika is also a founding member of Pi Link.
Well, thank you so much, and I really appreciate this opportunity to sit at the Asian American Conference and for inviting me to be on a literature panel, considering I'm a visual artist. So, but I also like the fact that they focus on storytelling, because that's where I have been seeing a bit. I came to New York in the mid-90s and was very interested in being involved in the Asian American community and was exposed to Godzilla, an Asian American Arts Network, which you might be familiar with, which is very involved in trying to increase representation of Asian American artists, but they really were not visible. We were trying to make sure that they were a part of exhibitions and galleries, and also presenting work in public spaces. And I also, at the time, one of my first jobs in New York was working with Asian American Arts Alliance. But as I became involved and exposed to all these Asian American arts organizations, having come from a small majority white town in our Heights, in the southern tier part of the state, just southwest of Finger Lakes, it was important for me to be involved with Asian American communities. At the same time, I was aware that there was a lack of diversity in terms of a multitude of voices being represented. And today, of course, another note is part of the 1.5% of Asian American women being Thai American. And so I think I've always been trying to figure out how I can project my voice, but also reaching out to others collectively. In 2003, I founded Thai Links, which is a collective dedicated to increasing awareness on issues affecting the Thai community through art and activism, and it's composed of artists and visual artists, graphic artists, architects, and those involved in community-based nonprofit arts organizations. So that's a bit of a long intro, but just trying to give you a little bit of a background. Illustrating my ideas, and I wanted to really interact with the public. I wanted the public viewers to be actively involved in that capacity of looking at a painting. This is actually a food case, which originally was red, which I painted to simulate lacquerware, Thai lacquerware, and it's called Looking Exotic. And wanted to emphasize what really makes, based on the perspective of the viewer, it's considered exotic. So it's actually painted with gold marker and gold paint. And I inserted, carved out the front of the suitcase, inserted this frame to get emphasize this idea of whose perspective and who the viewer is, and how what makes something appear exotic to another person. So when you peer in, this is what you see inside. Thrown inside the silk orchids are fast food wrappers which I collected. And I collaborated with an origami artist, Jun Sakamoto, and she came up with the appropriate flower that would allow these logos to appear on the petals. And in Thailand, and of course now due to globalization, you have fast food joints all over. And in Thailand, you can find these, you can find Starbucks and KFC and McDonald's and Pizza Hut in Bangkok and Chiang Mai, major cities in Thailand. And they're actually, it's a very bourgeois cuisine. I mean, you have to afford to go to these fast food places. And so it's very exotic to go to a fast food restaurant there. Depending on who the viewer is, what you think is exotic, the fast food wrappers or naturally native flowers or the are these orchids and others. This is called Looking or Seeing, and it's another suitcase. I forgot to mention that we're illuminating the thing and you peer in and see the whole internal space. Again, I was focused on who is the viewer, who's the one that's the object of being viewed. When you peer inside, this is what you see, the doll eyes. And what I, how I composed the piece was I had sewn the silver thread from one eye, and from each of the eyes, the doll eyes, this is the line in the case. So this sort of web of red and fine. And also, I was reflecting on my own experience of having been born in Buffalo, New York, being a second generation Thai American, and having had the experience of going back to Thailand and realizing that I was also a tourist in the homeland. And what is that experience mean with it between faces? Probably another reason why I've been going to. I'm not a first-generation immigrant, is that awareness that I'm not quite settled because I was having grown up feeling like a foreigner in a mostly white small town, and then that kind of urban experience, but identifying with the Asian American experience, but at the same time, still being perceived as a foreigner. So this case was created after 9/11, very aware of how immigrants were being perceived, and yet, especially New York, being projected as this welcoming haven for immigrants, but then having the imposition of label as foreigner. And of course, I see this very personally, even though I come from an immigrant experience with my parents' generation. And when you peer in, you see. Anyone who peers in was a foreigner. So I really wanted others to be able to have that kind of experience. This suitcase is part of a larger project that I presented at the Lori Seitz Hennepin Museum. And it was a series of 21 suitcases, actually. And it was a collaborative process where I invited people in New York to contribute an image or an object that relates to their immigrant story. And so it spanned over 100 years because for some people they were third or fourth generation, for others they were immigrant themselves, they didn't necessarily label themselves as having an immigrant experience, which is their experience. So I juxtaposed stories with the suitcases, and there were, I don't know if you're familiar with the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, but it has a storefront, and so it was viewable from the street, which was really important to me that art be accessible in that way. So I just wanted to read briefly Martha Ma's story. Martha Ma, who grew up in Flushing, Queens, and this is a photograph of her family. This was the last photograph of the entire family taken in Seoul, Korea before coming to the United States. This portrait marks the second major migration of my family's history. Both maternal and paternal grandparents had left Shandong, China, somewhere between the 1920s and 30s. My mother was born in North Korea, my father was born in the South. American soldiers later forced my mother's family into South Korea when she was just a child. But that's another story. This is where my parents met, married, and started a family. At the age of 33 and 34, my parents graciously took their family of 7 young girls between the ages of 15 and almost 1 year to America. I was just 3 years old at the time. We lived in a 2-bedroom apartment in Flushing, Queens, where 5 of us slept in a pull-out sofa bed. My mother, not able to speak any English, worked at an image sweatshop and also made beaded jewelry. My father, having studied English prior to his arrival to the U.S., drove a cab for the first few years without taking a single day off. How he managed to find the time to take us out on outings in nice weather remains a mystery to me. And what was wonderful about the process is that I interviewed each participant individually. And so they would even describe to me the type of luggage they traveled with. And Martha actually described that she remembered having a brown suitcase with large buckles that I didn't have time but she envisioned. And then it was really about this exchange, talking about our shared experiences, what we had in common, and what kind of challenges people faced, especially in commonalities and differences. And so the work of art was not just the object itself, it was really that whole process. So this became more of a documentation. This suitcase actually was first Josephine Valdez's story, which was attended in the Lower Side Tenement Museum. And the museum had these shoes, and they were going to throw them out. So I said, yeah, I could use them. So originally the story was about Josephine Valdez and how she, every Saturday, the family would be greeted by a box that would have things that they could use, and so the shoes, and how important it was for her, you know, delight was to find that box. And so the story was about that. But I, after the Lower Museum inauguration, I was invited to an exhibit in a solo show in Brooklyn. And I was interested in exhibiting this again, but it was a different relationship because I no longer was going to exhibit all 21 suitcases. Because I forgot to mention, because they were not my stories, they were their stories to keep and to share, continue to share with their family and friends. They were given to them. So I did not feel ownership of those stories. It was their stories to keep and to share. And that's the idea of the work to try to bring the PI to a one time exhibition. But this suitcase, since it wasn't specifically a living person, and because the shoes donated to the Lower East Side, I decided to transform it into my story, actually. And it's a children's ditty on the blackboard, and it says, "They feel playmate, come out, play with me, and we'll be friends forever, more and more, shut the door." It's not the whole ditty, but it's an excerpt. And I was thinking about the experiences that were shared during those interviews, and one thing was common was how people were teased in school, and I remember that was my grandchild's experience being teased a lot. And so I put sticks and stones with the children's the girls' shoes. And I liked how the stones also looked like eggs. And I have a niece and nephew too, so I was really thinking about what is their experience like. This is called carry-on baggage, and it's actually a larger piece in the bottom. almost the, like, it looks like the same size as Metro Marsh, the bottom. And it's galvanized wire. So galvanized wire from one suitcase into the other, and so suspended above. And I was thinking about the idea of first and second generation, the idea of family. One place of tension. Is the suitcase supporting the other, or is it holding the back? So why is it to be open to multiple interpretations? This is called the Glass Cleaner. Thinking about my parents' experience. But also just in general, even if it's not an experience, this idea of, this idea of hope and wanting to look forward and everything that is put into this idea of dreams and what can happen in the future. And the bottom is on the floor is a welcome mat. And so that's bamboo spiraling up to meet the suitcase. It's filled with wheatgrass. So it's wonderful when you're in the presence of it, you can smell the wheatgrass. Mm-hmm. And so there's this wire that holds the spiral together. I also like the idea of spiral. Even the metaphor of spiraling down is cool, this idea of wanting to control the outcome. This is called the other side. I created a border on the floor. And again, the hope is that we can have multiple interpretations at the time of what they're thinking about U.S. Foreign policy, domestic policy, and border control. And so you stand in front of the mirror, and the suitcase is suspended by this chain, and you physically turn it. One side says my side, the other side says your side. But all this while you keep turning it, and you're still putting yourself in the mirror. How are you able to identify with the other person's perspective? This is an installation of a public art project that I did. This is just documentation. It was a collaborative process. The immigration booth was designed by Miguel Oliveira, and I wanted to create a mobile immigration information booth. And it's mounted, and we had very limited budget. We had something with the arts council that was very, very limited. So we ended up constructing it from foam core. And it's mounted on a locker. And it was a collaboration with the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. In 2003, they were distributing a report on special registration, which you might be familiar with, states required men who are majority Muslim, not all, majority Muslim countries were required to register. And with the reports, I also distributed these postcards. And there were volunteers that carried the suitcase, the plexiglass. And one has the eye representing the injury act and the increased level of security, and the other a family focused on how families have been separated as a result of special registration. And had the household. Male has also been detained. They're often male, so you know where they were. They were receiving legal representation or translators very often. So volunteers were carrying these suitcases and traveling from the immigration booth. And while they're traveling, they were distributing postcards. And the idea was that they were. It was information that would hopefully stimulate dialogue and conversation and awareness. So there were true and false statements. So one was immigrants do not serve in the United States Armed Forces. True or false? Of course, it's false. There are currently over 58,800 immigrants serving in the armed forces, and over 11,000 foreign-born women are serving in the U.S. armed forces. And another statement was, immigrants receive more governmental assistance than citizens for a fault. Approximately 935,000 non-citizens lost benefits due to the passage of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity and Reconciliation Act of 1996. And by 1997, non-citizen families with incomes below 200% of poverty had welfare use rates that were significantly lower than citizen rates. And then I also had a statement saying, special registration has been effective means of fighting terrorists were false. Currently, which is at the time, it was a court case. There was an issue on behalf of South Asian Middle Eastern countries who had no ties to terrorists and were arrested in the wake of 9/11 on immigration charges by the IMS, which of course is now Front for Homeland Security, and they were held without due cause indefinitely in the Metropolitan Detention Center. And there's other information. And I also provide sites for people to go to for information. So in the beginning, I was thinking more about increasing awareness. But I was also later, as you know, as we're doing the project, and Elvis is doing the report, we also realized responsibility in terms of cleaning up signage that said said immigration visas to Brooklyn, that it was going to attract immigrants who had questions regarding their status or family status, and that's why it was also important to have an attorney present on the thing for those questions and do an intake survey. And we also distributed Know Your Rights cards. The use of the these are actually postcards. So the second incarnation was with Leadership of the Arts Project. And it was a collaborative process. And so this project was geared more towards immigrants. And not just, well, the other one also attracted immigrants as well, but you know, trying to be critical about how information is distributed and what information is distributed. So for this one, the youth that were involved, they decided they wanted to focus on the stereotype that immigrants are taking jobs away from Americans. And so they came up with a statement as a false statement that immigrants take jobs away from Americans. And to focus on how immigrants were actually creating jobs in the future, entrepreneurship. And we, on the other side, we had information hotline. Horizon and all that. And this was the third incarnation. Again, collaboration with all that, but working with educational equity. And they were focused, the youth for this program was interested in focusing on paper schools. They were getting physically abused at school. And so this was this. They wanted to focus on two stories, their stories. So Jerome, during my first 2 weeks in the United States, I was in my high school bathroom washing my hands, but some other students surrounding me and asked me if I could know to turn out and then secure it outside. So I didn't report the incident to them not to occur. So a lot of students, their rights were being violated, and it's not only students, but also just in terms of them being aware of what their rights are, if they're teachers and counselors. So the interest was really trying to get this information out there to them. And this was distributed in webinars, in particular because at the time, Op-Ed High School was being closed, and they also wanted to survey about this area. So, and Sweden's story also talked about how she was a witness to and the reason that the cards are due in Chinese is that those were the largest populations that were affected. So again, we really just wanted to focus on how information is distributed. So this is actually a girl hall. I should mention when the first time I tried to stage a project, it was in 2000. Well, I tried to get the permit in 2003, and 2004 is when it was held. And during that time, there was all this different work still in paranoia, but at the time we were in orange level alert. And so it took me a while to get the permit, and when I finally got the permit, then I was called and I was told that that police commissioner Kelly, that he was aghast that there were that the police precinct that Aaron was going to let me do this project was going to be security there. So I was going to Virginia to be able to see. So I ended up using plexiglass. But it was fighting for plexiglass because I really realized that it was going to be a problem. I just wanted to go, I know we're running out of time, so I just wanted to show you the last picture.